Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Anthropology. My name is Czarna Berkowicz, and today I will host this channel. My guest today is Martin Demant Frederiksen, who last year published a book called An Anthropology of Nothing in Particular. Martin, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Martin, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Yes, of course. I'm a social anthropologist, originally from the University of Aarhus in Denmark. Currently, I'm at the Department of Social Anthropology in Oslo. I have been conducting fieldwork in the Republic of Georgia for the last 15 years, I think, something like that. Originally, mainly about relations between time and materiality and experiences of boredom among subcultures in urban settings, and have more recently, also begun conducting fieldwork in Bulgaria and Croatia on somewhat similar themes and thematically, both in Georgia, Bulgaria, and Croatia on questions of nothingness and meaninglessness.
And how did you come to write An Anthropology of Nothing in Particular? What got you interested in thinking and writing about nothingness?
Well, by coincidence, in some sense. Originally, I was interested in doing research on atheism, and I had begun both doing or conducting some pilot interviews with people I knew in Georgia, and had begun reading about the theme. And one of the things that came up in the interviews was that when people were talking about atheism, they were not talking about atheism as such. I mean, they were not talking about disbelief only, or disbelief in a religious sense, but more about general senses of disengagement, or I mean, things that were verging on. On nihilism much more than on atheism. So I began kind of looking around for other anthropological studies about nihilism and about questions of nothingness, and was kind of surprised that there was so little of it compared to how much had been written about it in related or in other disciplines. I mean, in philosophy mainly, but also in novels and literature, in films, in plays, completely different disciplines such as astrophysics. I mean, a lot of places where nothingness had actually been had been described from a range of perspectives and quite thoroughly, but there wasn't really any anthropology of nothingness. So I became interested in it originally, just in the sense of thinking what an anthropology of nothing would look like.
And do you understand nothing as absolute lack of meaning, meaninglessness, or do you approach nothing as an absence of narrative meaning or a linear story? So in other words, could you maybe explain to our readers, could nothing from your perspective still contain fragments of meaning, although they may be randomly dispersed and not connected with one another in a meaningful way, so to say?
Well, I would say that it definitely contains fragments of meaning, and I think particularly from the vantage point that I have been writing from, which is largely Sartre's discussions about nothingness, and his position that you cannot talk about complete nothingness or a complete nothing. But at the same time, you also can't talk about a complete something, because the two always stand in a relation to each other. They cannot exist without each other. So we can talk about nothingness, which is kind of a something that is almost nothing, but as you say, still contains fragments of meaning. But we should, in principle, also talk about somethingness, because in every kind of something, there will always be a fragment of something meaningless or a fragment of a kind of nothingness. So you cannot have one without the other. And I think one of my vantage points was to say that, particularly in anthropology, it's by and large been the something side of that relation that has been explored. And what I was interested in was to look into the nothing side of it, which is not to look at something that lacks any kind of meaning, or as you say, an absolute meaninglessness, but something that is too random in a way to be called something.
The title of the book is An Anthropology of Nothing in Particular. So would you say this nothing in particular is just another term for waiting or for boredom? So throughout the book, you clearly demonstrate this much more, or if it's nothing, maybe much less than that. But could you perhaps explain the relationship between these concepts for our listeners?
Well, they definitely have a relation. And I think another kind of entry point I had into nothingness was actually boredom, because that was a theme that I'd been working on before. But I had met people who kind of questioned the way that I have been had been describing boredom, in the sense that I had been describing it mainly as a negative, or as a negative experience. Which boredom largely is seen as, and waiting is also largely seen as being something that's profoundly negative and something that we do our best to avoid. But I think in the research that came out of this project, I mean, boredom in a sense was still there, but it was there as an acceptance of boredom, or as an acceptance that life is not necessarily interesting, but there's also not necessarily anything you can do about that. It's just it's kind of an inherent fact of life. But also that waiting can have, it can have different kinds of forms, or there can be a telos of waiting that is different from the way we usually see it. Because we usually conceive of waiting as waiting for something, and not as a question of waiting for nothing, or being in a situation where something else ideally should happen, but you kind of know that it won't, which is a kind of waiting. But I would say it's a particular kind of waiting. So it's kind of a Samuel Beckett waiting for Godot waiting, where you're waiting for something that will never show up. But I think in the sense that it, or in the way that it appears in the book, it's like this, that you're waiting for nothing, that you're waiting for a difference that will never come around.
A difference that will never come around. It's a very nice way to describe nothing.
Yeah.
Since anthropology is inherently a comparative exercise, how does nothing in one place differ from nothing in another place? On pages 6 and 61, you write that, and this is a quote, "Nothing and meaninglessness exist in many different places and contexts, but these are not the same kinds of nothing." So what different ideas of nothingness did you come across in your work, and where do their specificities and differences come from?
Well, I think one of the tricky things about nothing is actually situating it. I think throughout the book tried in one way to do it and in another way not to do it in order to kind of have exactly a particular kind of nothing stand forth. While still somehow trying to create a general sense of nothingness. There was one book that inspired a lot of the writing or a lot of this thinking about nothing, which is Tom Lutz's book, Doing Nothing. And in this, he actually tries to, on the one hand, also carve out nothing, but say that we have to acknowledge that there are different varieties of it. And his vantage point is saying that in his own youth, in the 50s and 60s, his parents' generation were always complaining that his friend and him were doing nothing. They were doing nothing with their lives. Because they were reading beat literature and they were jumping on trains like Jack Kerouac and kind of distancing themselves from society. And then he found later on, when he himself had children, that he had a teenage son who also engaged in doing nothing but did it in a profoundly different way, which was lying on the couch. Which got him interested in saying, well, how does the figure of nothingness, in the sense of doing nothingness, actually, how is it performed, or how does it differ across generations? So he basically wrote a historical account of different types of figures in the US that have been related to the question of doing nothing. So you can actually pinpoint nothingness in specific sites, I would say. And I think a reason for that is exactly its relation to something. I mean, the fact that particular kinds of nothingness are related to different kinds of somethingness. So when something is different, then nothing will inherently also be slightly different. Which I also think it is in the context that I describe. And I don't go into it much. I think I mentioned it on these pages and kind of give a few glimpses of other kinds of nothingness, which has mainly been the kinds of nothingness that people have suggested to me or reminded me of when I've been talking about the project, I mean, to friends or to colleagues. And there are two examples that have almost always been mentioned, which is, I mean, one being Seinfeld, and the other being The Big Lebowski. So people have always asked, I mean, how does it relate to these two kinds of nothingness? So, I mean, a show about nothing, which Seinfeld said itself to be, and the nihilists of The Big Lebowski. And the thing is that it is, in one sense, of course, there are similarities, but they are also profoundly different kinds of nothing. Because they're related to completely different contexts. So, I mean, first of all, they're fictional. That's one. that's one aspect. I mean, if you take a group of singles living in New York in the 1990s, I mean, what they relate to, or what the nothingness that transpires in that context is related to, is different from what I'm describing. I'm deliberately not trying to be too specific about the context I describe, because I wanted to try to, in a sense, present a sensation of a particular kind of nothingness that readers can relate to or not.
And how useful did you find the standard anthropological vocabulary for your exploration of nothingness. So anthropology is usually concerned with translating meaning from there to our point of view, whoever they and us may be, so to say. And how did you engage in this task of translation from nothing to nothing, both when doing research and when writing?
I think when doing research, a lot of it came around as a dialogue between my interlocutors and myself, because in a sense of my own relation to nothingness and my own perception of what nothingness might be, or my own compulsion to make sense of things, which is in a way what I was brought up to do academically, because I mean that's what anthropology is largely about. I mean, we try to make sense of things. So I mean, a lot of it, took its vantage point in my own inability to kind of comprehend what this was, and something that actually led to discussions about nothingness during research. Not that we try to convince each other of what meaning was or what it might be or why it might be lacking. But I think in the book there are a lot of my own hesitations are definitely present as a very distinct me, and my own udenophobia or my own fear of nothing in terms of thinking about these themes that were severely challenged during research. But that part was, in a sense, it was relatively easy because, I mean, it became a dialogue about the theme. I think it became much more difficult when I actually had to write about it, because there isn't really a vocabulary of nothingness in anthropology. I mean, there are related themes that you can kind of pick up on. I mean, doubt or invisibility or dissolution or absence, but there isn't really a distinct language to talk about nothing. So I think the places where I drew my inspiration or where I kind of had my academic debates were with text and authors outside of anthropology. In philosophy mainly, but also in film theory and in absurdist theater.
Yes, and as I was reading the book, actually, I had all these associations to queer theory, as I mentioned to you mm-hmm. earlier. So first, the way your interlocutors interact with one another and with you reminded me a lot of the so-called queer sociality. Mm-hmm. One of your key informants, Oz, who is quite a character, behaves similarly to what Elizabeth Povinelli describes as stranger sociality. So he navigates social relations and estrangement in a very particular way, which goes against the usual reciprocity, give and take of friendship or romance. And second, the relationship of your interlocutors towards time seems to be profoundly queer. And by this, I mean unconcerned with productivity, future, success, happiness, life stages. And it reminded me of an embrace among various queer communities of that which in the middle-class heterosexual worlds would be called failure or emptiness or meaninglessness. There are references to queer motifs throughout the book, but there is little explicit use of queer theory, although you as you mentioned, draw theoretical inspiration from various disciplines and modes of writing and various sources. So do you see any intersections or overlaps between an anthropology of nothing in particular and queer theory, and if yes, where are these intersections?
Well, I think there definitely is an overlap. I mean, I'm not sure I would call the book in itself queer theory, but mainly because it doesn't deserve it, in the sense that, as you say, I mean, I engage kind of superficially with themes that are definitely prominent in queer theory, without necessarily unfolding them very much. But I think if you were to put a theoretical perspective on the book, queer theory would be a really good place to start. I mean, you could say in a sense existentialism is my vantage point, but queer theory in a sense might actually have worked just as well, if not better. And I think, I mean, one of the people that I draw on is Sarah Ahmed and her writings on relations and particularly on linearity, which is really a theme that runs throughout the book, in terms of looking at what happens in a sense besides the linear, or what happens in situations that are not straightforward, or where linearity is broken. And I think, again, if we take this nothingness, somethingness relation, I mean, linearity in this context is part and parcel of the context or the something that a lot of this is related to or stands in opposition to. And there are things that... that in a sense I would have liked to include more of in terms of depicting that or depicting the context or I don't know how you can put it, but the atmosphere of what was taking place. One of it is something as simple as music, for instance. I mean, you could, in a sense, you could very easily create a soundtrack that would fit that would fit this book in terms of the music that was continuously listened to by these groups, which is definitely also in what you could call, I mean, the queer category. I mean, everything from Pet Shop Boys to post-punk or any kind of music that kind of seeks to break with the ordinary or ideas of normality. The very concrete reason why I didn't go into that was simply copyright issues. I mean, I wasn't allowed to use the lyrics that I wanted to in the book. So, I mean, if I ever get permission to do that, there might be a sequel. But no, I think there is a series of overlaps, as you mentioned, in relation to ideas of linearity and to of being, as you say, unconcerned with the future, or kind of embracing your own disengagement or your own seclusion from something that is seen by others as being normal or being linear.
And one thing that our listeners should know is that the city and the country where the book takes place are not named in the book. So we don't know where your fieldwork took place and so on. So why did you decide not to name the city and the country and to strip your story of most social markers, especially if there are different kinds of nothingness in different places? So I really like the narrative effect of this decision. But could you maybe reflect upon how you made this decision and what was gained by it and what was perhaps lost by it?
Well, it wasn't. I mean, first of all, it's not that it's a secret where all of this took place. But the specific reason for in a sense, deleting the context deleting the city and the country was that during writing, I kind of felt that I needed to find a style that represented the content. So I started looking through the draft of the manuscript to kind of find cues or ideas to in terms of what I could do to pursue that. And one very simple thing was that it was mentioned at one point very randomly by one of the people there that geography is pointless. I mean, there's no point to geography. So, I mean, the original idea to delete the city was simply to say, okay, but if I took that seriously, what would it do to the manuscript? So I basically went into the draft and started deleting the names of all place names to see what effect it would have. And one other reason for doing it was that the original draft was written as, I guess you could say, kind of a standard monograph with an introduction, a chapter about the context, and then distinct chapters on specific themes. But when I had almost finished that, it felt like I was kind of betraying the content of the book, because I was trying to order it. I was trying to make sense of things and place things into categories that, so to speak, the field had tried to dissolve. So I started, in a way, breaking the narrative of that first draft, to kind of follow, I mean, the Tarkovsky principles of film editing by erasing chronology in it, by erasing context, by putting in pieces of fiction or pieces of text that really doesn't fit with the rest of the book, in order to break any sense of linearity in the manuscript overall. So one part was to kind of stick to this claim that geography is pointless, and another part was, in a sense, a stylistic choice. And I think what it does is that it, in my opinion at least, I think nothingness actually stands forth as, I don't know if you can say clearer, but as the sense of it, I think, becomes stronger. I mean, the down point or the downturn is that you can't really relate it to anything specifically. Now, the previous book I wrote with Katrine Gottfredsen about the Roast Revolution in the Republic of Georgia, where this takes place, I mean, that's not a secret, in a sense, ends where this book begins. I mean, it ends with sensations or return sensations of disillusion and sensations of nothingness. And I think it was also because I felt that that book actually serves as the context for this book. So I mean, you can read them in tandem if you kind of want the more regional perspective on it.
Well, as I was reading the book, I assumed it took place in an East European country, and I think that you describe this as a compulsion to find meaning, and I was looking for like cues of where this could be located and so on. Mm-hmm. And since you keep the country and the city anonymous in the book, and since it is mostly a theoretical treatise on how we can anthropologically approach nothingness, I couldn't help but wonder, is it possible to make a universal argument that would be ethnographically situated in Eastern Europe? So I'm thinking here about the specific position of Eastern Europe in anthropological knowledge production as neither Western modern nor colonial or post-colonial other. So would the placing the story about nothingness into particular Eastern European context, social context, somehow make your argument too regionally specific and therefore difficult to link to other places and other forms of nothingness? What do you think?
Well, I think it could definitely be done. And I think if you read the book having some knowledge about Eastern Europe, I think it is, as you say, recognizable. I mean, I'd also be interested in hearing what you recognize as Eastern European in it. But I think there are things that transpire that you can read if you live in this region or if you've conducted research or visited the region. And I think you're in a sense spot on in terms of saying that there are things that are specific to Eastern Europe in terms of kind of being neither or, which is what I've been interested in relation to the research I've been doing in Bulgaria and Croatia, or that I'm conducting now, is to say what is this kind of either or aspect of this particular region, which is it has a sense of almost about it, that it's almost a colonial other but not quite, and it's almost Western modern but not quite. But it's still there. So again, it's not that it's nothing, but it's also not a particular kind of something, or it's difficult to pinpoint what kind of something this is. And I don't have any any conclusions on that now. But I think, the book could easily have been written as an ethnography that was very firmly situated in Eastern Europe, and in relation to, a lot of writings that explore similar themes that have been prominent in post-Soviet and post-socialist studies. I mean, primarily in terms of something like disillusion. But as you say, I think the aim for me here was to say that the book is not about anything. You know, it's about a particular kind of sensation. So it's not about Georgia, and it's not about Eastern Europe, even though you could read it as such if you'd want to. But one of the things I'm experimenting with now is to say that if you take some of the same principles that are used in writing this book, like essentially deleting the context or deleting place names, would it be possible to write something that actually compares different places in Eastern Europe? Or that compares the material that I have from Georgia, Bulgaria, and Croatia, and also from Albania, in order to see what kind of nothingness would transpire from that, which I'm sure would be something different. But I'm not sure. I haven't decided whether that's the right way to compare it. I think. Doing a cross-cultural comparison of nothingness would be really interesting. If anyone's interested in doing that with me, they should just please call, because I don't have the material to do it. I'd be interested to know what was recognizable as Eastern European to you when you read the book.
That is a good question. I guess because I knew about your earlier research in Georgia and current research in Croatia and Bulgaria.
Yeah.
I do want to mention it. I think that your decision to rewrite the first draft, which was, as you mentioned, academic with introduction and the clear setting and so on, to rewrite it into the current version, published version of the book, is, in my view, a very good one, because it's a very original piece of writing, which was a lot of fun to read, so I warmly recommend it to our listeners. I think that we've taken up a lot of your time, and in the last few minutes, I would like to ask you if you could tell us what you're working on now a bit more. So you mentioned you're doing research in Bulgaria and Croatia. What it is about, and how is this new research going?
Well, it is in a sense a continuation of this interest in nothingness, but there's more something in what I'm doing now. But I think I briefly mentioned what I'm interested in is things that are I guess you could say almost but not quite. The notion of on, I mean, things that are on something, so things that verge upon almost being without quite ever making it there. And more specifically, what I'm working with is not, it's not, you could say it's not a particular group, or it's not social relations in the same way as it is in the Nothing book, but relates more to the built environment and to particular forms of architecture in Georgia, Bulgaria, and Croatia, that kind of verge upon being something that they are not quite. So ruins that are not quite ruins, or buildings that are historical but not quite heritage. So you could say material structures that, in a way, occupy an uneasy position between nothingness and somethingness. I think that's as clear as I can make it for now.
The book was published last summer, if I'm correct. And I was wondering how, if you can maybe share with us a little bit of how different people responded to it.
Well, they've been responding decidedly differently. And I think that actually speaks to some of the things that we've been discussing, both in terms of the style of the book and these different kinds of nothing, because when people I know from Georgia have either read the book, or when I've been kind of broadly discussing the themes of the book, I think the things that I have written about are extremely recognizable to them. So they relate it very specifically to a societal situation. There was one old friend who said that it's, in some sense, it's very much a Georgia book, because Georgians are obsessed with nothingness. They're obsessed with nothing. We talk about it all the time. It's been very different when people I know in Norway or Denmark have read the book, because they've kind of picked out themes of the book that they can relate to aspects of their own life. So some have related it to questions of work life balance, that you have to we need to embrace nothingness more. We need to be more positive about doing nothing, or accepting that things might be meaningless, and a lot have related it to questions of Buddhism and meditation. I mean, the village where I lived in Denmark had there was an abundance of yoga instructors and mindfulness teachers. And they saw kind of a very direct link between the sensation of the book and questions of Taoism, for instance, which is something that I never heard mentioned by people I know in Georgia. And I think the benefit of the book having been written, in a sense, without the context, is that it becomes perhaps more easy for people to relate to some aspect of it. Or some aspects of it, or to think about some aspects of it. And that's also, in a sense, been one of the goals of the book, not to give any answers about nothingness, but to give and or provide an invitation to consider it in new or in different ways.
And were there perhaps any voices that were critical of the lack of productivity of your interlocutors?
Well, there definitely has been, and I think in a Scandinavian context, if we can call it that, I mean the question of doing nothing is very easily read as a negative, as something that's unproductive, because it's not. You have to be participate in civil society, and nothing will come out of disengaging from it, which is paradoxical because this runs parallel to people actually wanting to do nothing more, who work a lot in order to do nothing during their holiday. But there is this idea that doing something and doing nothing should be kept separate. And shouldn't be kind of mixed together in the way that it is in the book. And then there are people who are really annoyed by the way it's written. I mean, by this kind of broken narrative style. So I've certainly had complaints about that.